Welcome to The Wayne Nicholson Show, where our guests share their fascinating stories. If you have any questions or would like to DM us, we would love to hear from you. We also have a YouTube channel and a Facebook page.
Kim Bidstrip is on the podcast today, as we simply know him as Bid. Bid has worked for over 28 years in radio and television and served many of those years as a journalist. He was the European correspondent, the London bureau chief, as well as working for the Seven Network here in Australia. We talk about all things positive and negative when it comes to that industry and exactly what led Bid to step away from it, mainly to save his mental health from the tragic and gruesome things that he had witnessed. To escape that, he stepped in front of the camera as an actor and has worked in more than 50 productions of feature films, television series, documentaries, docudramas, stage plays, web series, digital productions. He has since been an acting teacher, a TV presenter, a voiceover artist, and more interestingly, a funeral celebrant. But what I found most interesting about Bid was his deep belief in the way of the Hopi, which derives from the Native American tribes that reside in Arizona today. I had a fascinating chat with Bid, and I learned a lot from this man, and I'm sure you will too. This episode is brought to you by Egypt Fun Tours. Now, I always said if Indiana Jones was to take a tour throughout Egypt, then Egypt Fun Tours would be the company he would book through. I can vouch personally, having booked this company when traveling to Egypt in 2019. If you are looking for a professionally guided service, which is knowledgeable, fun, and sometimes off the beaten track, then you can't beat Egypt Fun Tours. You see, my wife and I went with the private tour, which was personalized to our own interests and needs, which you can do with Egypt Fun Tours. We traveled from the south, visiting beautiful Abu Simbel, right up to the magical Alexandria. We got to spend alone time, would you believe, in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, as well as camping with the Bedouins in the White Desert. We learned how to read hieroglyphs, and we visited the beautiful temples of Abydos and Dendera, which sometimes is not included on tours. So for more information on Egypt Fun Tours, check out their Facebook page, Egypt Fun Tours, or their website, egyptfuntours.com. This episode is also brought to you by Deli's Continental. From just one pop-up and one sandwich, their reputation spread quickly, selling out whatever they prepared in 20 minutes. Boasting their continental rolls are the best in Australia, with every ingredient fresh and made in-house. Now, within months, these two owners, Steve McCluda and Aldo Putsu, had already graced the pages of magazines, websites, and newspapers. Rumours are now stirring that this could be big. If you are interested in what all the fuss is about, and you are lucky enough to live in Perth, Western Australia, why not head down to Deli's Continental, number 2/861 Beaufort Street, Inglewood, with their grand opening set to be this summer 2021. For more information, you can check out their Instagram and Facebook page, Deli's Continental.
The influences, and my father, I'd love to talk about my dad. My dad was a very, like all of us, but a kind of flawed man, but just, I adored him, a remarkable, he could mimic anybody, every bit of voice work I've ever done, every character I've ever played is an aspect of my dad.
Oh, really?
I have no imagination.
But I think that's quite common.
Yeah. My dad was a genius.
Don't you find as you get old, you know, you go from that listening and viewing your parents on a pedestal, because when you're a kid, they're the adults and they sort of are the wise elders. And then as you get older, as you get older, you start to see the flaws in a human being.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, he's got flaws.
My dad was this extraordinary mimic. He had a very, very difficult life, but I'll tell the story later, but he just had the most profound influence on me. He was had the propensity and was capable of being a violent alcoholic, which he was, but he was also this beautiful sense. He was an extraordinarily complex man, but I owe him everything, any scintilla of creativity I have, I owe to listening to his stories. He could do goon shows. Entire goon shows wrote, which some people might think it is a trivial talent, but as a child, this is the ultimate silly storytelling, you know?
Yeah.
It's just magical. He didn't read me bedtime stories. He'd recite bits from The Navy Lark or Jimmy Edwards or Dave Allen or whatever. It's a strange way to grow up, but it's a pretty exciting way to grow up.
Before we start, I would love if my father could recite me as a child, Dave Allen, with a glass of whiskey and beside my bed. I can just imagine that in a fag.
Yeah, my dad would even do the finger because Dave Allen had one missing finger, you know. My dad was a whiskey drinker, so
he would do the
whole Dave Allen. And my dad was very anti-religion, so Dave Allen never missed a chance
to talk about, Ben. Heaps to talk about. And, you know, it's funny because we've never sat down and actually had a decent conversation because it's always been the friend of Fern because you're her student.
One of the things I worry about is that you've had some just blindingly fascinating people on this show, seriously.
But if you noticed, it was never about the art form, it was about how they got to do the art form.
True.
That's something I've had a lot of sports people on.
Mm.
I'm not a sports person at all. You know, I've had gold medalists and Brownlow medalists.
Oh, you had Lulu Horton on.
Yeah.
She's fantastic. Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, I'm catching up with her this week.
Yeah, so, bang, bang. She's amazing.
But it's always about the journey, and that's what I've always been interested in. And I keep telling people that because a lot of people that have wanted to come on didn't because they were a bit intimidated by the previous guest.
Mm.
So I'm trying to get away from that. I'm trying. So the next few, a lot of the guests I've got coming on, I thought what would be really nice is to talk about, you know, I've got a girl from Iran coming, a girl from Mexico, a guy from Brazil, and talking about the sea change and coming to Australia and living here. And, you know, and I think to me, the most interesting stories are those that you listen to on the bus, the guy next to you talking to his wife. So they're the stories I'm wanting to capture.
Okay.
Well. So for me, Bid, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me.
Like normal, we end up talking an hour before we start the show and an hour after, you know, we finish. But so many questions, and I'm so happy that you've given time to come on. Like how long are you in Perth for?
Only a couple of days. I'm here for, different reasons.
Hanging out with the daughter.
Oh, the daughter, my beautiful daughter is getting married. So that's a huge thing, but and for complex reasons, I couldn't come to her engagement party. How's that? What kind of father doesn't go to their daughters?
I'm sure you had a good reason.
I know. I'll rot in hell.
And I'm sure she understands.
She did. So, but I'm here now. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So you live in Esperance right now.
Oh yes.
I was going to talk to you
about it. Paradise adjacent. It's not paradise, but you can see paradise from there.
Well, I see it through your photos.
Thank you. Yeah.
That's how we contacted. That's how I contacted you. I was looking at your photos and going, oh.
Esperance is, I was lucky enough in a previous career to travel a lot. And Esperance is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. It speaks to me. It's just exquisite. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place.
Did you always know that you would end up there?
Not there. I was born in a tiny little country town, which probably doesn't even exist now, called Wakery on the River Murray in South Australia. And it's now, I think, the Wakery Bakery plus a service station and a rising salt table. I don't think it's much else. My wife was, although she was born in Melbourne, both her parents were geologists, and she grew up and was raised in Norseman. So Norseman, for the people who don't know, is just a couple of hours north of Esperance, and people in that region tend to gravitate to Esperance for holidays. It's a beautiful seaside spot, really, really beautiful seaside spot. So my son works as an agronomist in Esperance. Mary and I, my wife and I, had always promised ourselves that we were going to one day, you know this conversation, one day we will, you know that conversation that begins, you know, one day we will. One day we will return to our country roots. At first, the reason was, well, I at that time was the breadwinner. My wife is now the breadwinner. I can't really do what I do in the places that we want to I'll end up in. Later on, when my wife was predominantly the breadwinner, we can't really do that there. I finally just bit the bullet, got a job in radio in a nearby town, and for various reasons, which I loved. Incidentally, I love radio. We can talk endlessly. I'm sorry about radio. So many things about radio. That didn't work out for a whole bunch of silly reasons. And so we moved to Esperance, and it's just, I just love it. Just, it's, I found peace, purpose, and pace, I always say. And that's really cool at 70. I just feel, I wake up every morning and say, I can't believe I get to do this. I can't believe I live here. I can't believe this is where, not where, I don't think anyone ever ends up anywhere. I don't really like that expression. But if, to use an expression you used earlier, if this had to be the end, then this is a pretty this is a pretty damn good end, you know. What's not to like about this?
Do you think people always tend to gravitate to return to a place they call home?
I think it varies. I think I have some friends who are similarly artistically inclined, and I can't see it happening for them. Not in a bad way, but because it's very important to them to keep experiencing new things and new vistas and new heights, for want of a better thing. A couple of them would be mutual friends, I think, people you would know, but I can't see them. There's a restlessness, a wonderful, creative, energetic, exciting restlessness about them that I don't think they would be happy doing that. But for me, you know, by no means am I saying, well, you know, I've done it all, or not that at all. But age and stage is a magical thing. You get to a certain age and stage, and this feels completely right. It just feels perfect. And I was reluctant to go to Esperance. I made up all the reasons in the world to my wife. We were in a place called Albany. For people who don't know, that's maybe 5 hours away along the coast, but a much bigger place.
Great museum there.
Great. Beautiful. Yeah, fantastic place. And my concerns were, and this is the joke. This is God's little joke, really. My concerns were, what about the internet? I won't be able to do what I do. You know, Esperance won't have, you know. What about, I have a medical condition. What about the medical care? You know, I'm 70, so you worry about these things.
Sure.
But mostly I said to her, what am I going to do creatively? And the implication of that was, well, you know, these are a bunch of hayseeds, and nothing could be further from the truth. I have met there one of the greatest actors, for example, that I have ever worked with. She's just extraordinary, just, you know, should be on the world stage, just an amazing actor and a collaborator and writer. I've worked in community radio. Because of the COVID lockdown, I wandered into a place called Esperance Community Arts, and suddenly they needed radio plays produced. Well, I mean, what are the chances
things
of that?
Things always, you know, happen and work out.
What are the chances of that? Some guy who started in radio and has just finished radio, who has the time and really wants to do it. We started, we did workshops and things. We started with two or three ideas. We ended up producing 11, not just me, but producing 11 radio plays for a regional festival. And it's been this, not only...
This was in Albany?
In Esperance. This is the place I said would be, you know, what am I going to do creatively? You know, I'm now shooting my own film there. I have started a writer's group there, et cetera.
So you found your footing.
It just goes on and on and on of the creative people who are there. Met the most extraordinary group of writers there, really, really talented published writers who've come there. I know two of the most talented. I know nothing about sculpture, but...
Oh, that's something I've always wanted to do.
Me too. My wife has engaged with pottery, and in a period of far less than a year has become this extraordinary potter, you know, in her spare time. Mary can do anything.
Don't you think it's when you slow down?
Yes.
You have those time to think about, maybe I've always wanted to do this. Like for me, I've always had an attraction to blacksmiths. I've always had an attraction to sculpturing.
Yes.
Like a lot of my internet time and YouTube time and Instagram is looking at the guys in Europe doing the sculptures out of marble and wood. And I don't know, I just find it fascinating. I love that art form. I probably would suck at it, but just to be able to get something done.
That's exactly what Mary's joined. My wife has joined Men in Sheds down there. She's joined the pottery.
Really?
That's her thing.
Fantastic.
It's not mine. I've gone into photography and film and radio. But, yeah, I think it is absolutely being in a kind of clear headspace to – you know what, I hope this doesn't sound judgmental, but maybe I'll just apply it to myself. But I think I was so out of touch, I was so busy being busy, that I was so out of touch with what I actually wanted to do. And I think it's exactly what you said. I think when I stopped, I realized, well, gee, I'd like to pick up a still camera again. Well, I haven't picked up a camera. I'd never used a DSLR until, a digital camera.
Sure.
My last camera was an FTN Nikon. We rolled our own film in about 1975. So to pick up on your point, why did that occur to me in Esperance? And I think it's exactly what you said, because everything was calm and suddenly this opportunity thought, well, here's this beautiful landscape, this extraordinary landscape. Why don't you go and shoot it?
Isn't there a piece that comes with that? I know, because I love photography.
Mm.
And the reason why I got into photography was I was a director at the time, and I just had enough of every time you wanted to tell a story, it was this Everest climb that you had to do.
Mm.
Because, you know, there's many parties involved. Like you need the help of many different people. And if you're wanting to do something on a bit of a bigger scale, you need to constantly bang your head against the wall to prove to people that you can do this film and give me the money and do this. And so one day, would you believe my father was an amateur photographer? He developed all his own film in the bathroom. And so I took a still camera out and I started to take photos. And, you know, I got so much enjoyment from that, because here I was visually telling a story and all I needed was my camera and myself.
Exactly. No filters, no pun intended, but no filter between you and the scene.
No. And I just found
the meditative quality of that.
I think that's what it was. It was the peace I found from doing that.
Mm.
And then being able to share it quite quickly compared to film, to be able to go out, take a photo, come back, share it with the world.
I literally tell myself it's God's way of telling me to be in the moment, because you have to be.
You have to, yeah.
And my, as you know, but maybe some people don't know, my special passion is long exposure photography. So you are literally sitting there with the scene for sometimes a couple of minutes. Doesn't sound like a long time, but you really are taking in this film at the same time as the digital image is being taken in. It's fantastic.
Do you know, speaking
it's
of that,
fantastic.
I learned a trick along my travels.
Don't do it.
No, they had a guy would put on an ND10.
Yes.
So basically a black, completely black. And he'd go to the busiest places on earth, like the crossroad. You know, what's the crossing in Japan? Shibuya crossing with 3,000 people.
Yeah.
And what he found is if he had a friend standing in the middle,
yes,
and he would do a 10-second exposure with the ND10, that a lot of his photos would look like his friend is the only one standing on the cross.
Yeah, I've actually done this.
Have
yes.
you?
Yeah.
I tried it. I tried it once and I just think, oh, my God, like just these little long exposure tricks these guys were doing.
I've got the ability to stop the camera down 16 stops, which for those of you who know photography is a lot.
Yeah, it is.
So you can have very, very long exposures and you get that amazing effect and in fact, there's a whole Russian exhibition, as I understand it, a couple who did exactly that. They went to some of the busiest. Unfortunately, it looked a little bit like a kind of COVID environment now, but before, if you know what I mean.
I never thought about that.
Yeah.
Because now people would go, went out through COVID.
Exactly. but before that, it was the most, so mm-hmm. you'd be, you know, as we were discussing earlier, you'd be at the Coliseum totally alone.
Yeah.
You know, which is pretty difficult to do. Or there's the most beautiful one of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris with mm-hmm. no cars going around. Well, try achieving that in real life without an ND filter. It had this, I can't think of the word, but I'm going to say timeless quality about it, this magical quality about it, because you think, I know that's a perfect photo of the Ark, but it's a version of it I've never seen, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not photoshopped, obviously.
Yeah. I could sit here all day and talk photography with you. And I was lucky enough to have on Simon Leekius, who's one of the top fashion photographers. But when we spoke, it was often his childhood influence in photography. Yeah. And he said, you know, Wayne, I was taken back to Greece when I was 10. Mm. And I've got a photo of me with my father's like digital, not digital, but, you know, his SLR. And he said he took a few photos and he was hooked. And then he started to do event photography and the big day out. And it was just great to talk about how he progressed in his journey of photography.
I heard that episode. It's amazing.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, of course.
Oh.
and for me, I'm not crying poor, but we didn't have much money when I was a kid. But my mum always bought what was then Time Life.
Yeah.
And so I saw Cartier-Bresson. And I saw, you know, some of these.
The education of photos.
Exactly. Yeah. And I saw all of these really brilliant, what we would now maybe call photojournalists, et cetera, and thought, you know, I got to do this. Some way I've got to do this.
Well, let's rewind, because I want to talk to you about your life in journalism, going back to being a European correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
And you worked with the British, the London.
Yeah, the London Bureau.
Yeah. Now, how did that come about within your world of journalism?
Okay. So I was a dreadful aspiring actor in my teens.
Is that right?
Did a lot of attempting to do that. And I was a very shy, gangly kid from a country town, and I had nothing to offer, and I no emotional experience. I was dreadful, but I knew I wanted to do that or write. My parents told me to get my hair cut and get a real job. I know that's a line from a song, but they really did. Bear in mind, my parents had both gone to war. They'd both been raised in the Depression. It was all coming from a really good place.
They were grounded.
They were grounded, and I had a love of radio, which we can talk about. So I was very fortunate to get, and I mean extraordinarily fortunate, to get my first job in radio. And I loved it, and after a while it loved me. I was dreadful at first. I'm not good with mechanical processes. A beautiful man named Jeffrey Raymond Potter Medwell, who was my first news director, took me aside after 6 months and said, Bid, you know that half the staff have come to me and said that you're really not going to make it, but I believe in you. Yeah, it was one of many moments that changed my life.
That's all you need, right?
Yeah.
One person.
Yeah. And to put that into context, these poor people who had legitimately done that were really good journos, and they were training this kid, me, who didn't come from a journalistic background. Most people that they'd trained before were copy boys. At that time, the radio station I was working for was on the second floor of the news building in Adelaide, which is the first building that Rupert Murdoch owned. So we used to see Rupert coming in and out. This is 1970. And so they would train these people up. As soon as these people were trained, they would go and get a cadetship somewhere else. And they were just sick to death of training these kids up, seeing them depart. Not only that, he was a kid they were training up, but he just wasn't getting it. He couldn't do mechanical things. We would have a feed every day from 3RW. It was the sort of mainstay of everything that wasn't locally produced, was centralized then. It was what used to be called the Macquarie Radio Network, and it was centralized at 3AW in Melbourne. So all of the world news, all of the national news came from 3AW. One of my jobs was to note down what those stories were and to record them. I would regularly erase that tape, not deliberately. And bear in mind, this is the days we were physically splicing tape. So when it was gone, it was gone. One of a number of things that I just didn't get, just couldn't do. I couldn't type. Every copy boy that they'd trained before, of course he could type. He knew all of the roundsmen in the building that the radio station could get leads from. I didn't know any of that. So I just want to be fair to the people who are saying, like, this,
sure, no,
get rid of this kid. But you're right. What Jeff Medwell said to me made all the difference. And the end of that story is that I ended up being the youngest person ever graded as a journalist and getting there the fastest, went on to do talk back and a whole bunch of things in radio that I never dreamt about doing, political reporting, a whole bunch of things. Ended up interviewing every prime minister from Malcolm Fraser all the way through to Rudd, you know. So this was the gift of radio and immediacy and being able to tell a story. You said a wonderful thing a little while ago, and I'm sorry this takes a little bit of time to tell this story, but I always tell this to my kids. The very first story that I wrote for radio, I still remember it almost word for word. So I wrote The Power of All Powers, and it said, South Australia's Prices and Consumer Affairs Commissioner, Mr. H.R. Baker, has announced today that for the second time in 3 months, cigarettes will rise by, I can't remember how much, from the 14th of February. And Jeff Mendel, my boss, looked at that and said, well, that's great. That's terrific. You just told me the entire story. That's great. You get it. You know, those are the details. Who, what, where, why, when, how. Yeah? It's not rocket science. Yes?
Right.
Good for you. But this is radio. Number one, in radio, somebody is almost always doing something else when they're listening. Number two, they get one chance to hear it. Number three, it's not the way we process information. Now, tap me on the shoulder in the front bar and tell me the story. And he turned around, I tapped him on the shoulder and I said, fags are going up again. And he said, yeah. And he says, plenty of time to tell me all of the rest. And he said, oh, and by the way, you can't, yeah, he corrected the tense that I'd incorrectly used it. And he said, who cares whether H.R. Baker said it, blah, blah, blah. But basically he said, yeah, cigarettes are going up again. That's, you can tell them all, that's what they want to know. That's what you tell your neighbour. And I've never forgotten it in storytelling. Mm. That you can be as clever as you damn well like, but if it's not clear, if it doesn't make somebody feel something or it doesn't inform them, no, you missed. And I've never forgotten it. I'm not saying I always practice it because no actor does, but I've never forgotten it as an actor either, because you can be smart as an actor. You can use technique. You can do this, that, and the other. But if it gets in the way of somebody feeling something, what's the point?
That's right.
You've been really clever.
It's funny the lessons you learn in other industries, mm-hmm, that you can transform. I remember my wife talking to me about law and when she became a lawyer, just the prose, like how she had to bring something across in writing. It was very active. It was an active voice and you get to the point. You take out all the words that you don't need. And she brought that along to editing when it came to story. Suddenly, when she got a story, what are you trying to say here? It's almost similar to what you just said.
Absolutely.
Fags are going up.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's funny that the little lessons you learn in other industries. And, I mean, all your journalistic experiences – actually, was there any stories that really stood out to you that influenced you in a way from that time?
I did 14 years of radio in various guises and news reading, talk shows, political interviews, specialised in political stuff. Became very disillusioned with the political process, incidentally, but maybe that's something we won't go into. And was lucky enough to meet the then remember I said that the hub of the Macquarie network was 3AW. The head of the network at that time was a guy called Vincent Smith. He went into television. He had an hour-long news, not forced upon him, but sort of thrust upon him in the days. This is way before anybody had done an hour-long news at a station called ATN 7 in Sydney. So he started ringing people that he knew from his Macquarie days, because he knew at least that we had a very strict style guide. He knew that he could mould these journalists. And I have no idea what possessed me, because I wasn't particularly confident. But he rang me and said, would you come and work in Sydney? And I said, I will if I'm considered for a foreign posting. I don't know where that came from. It really isn't me.
If you don't ask, Bid.
I know. I get that now, and I would do that now. But that wasn't – I wasn't that guy then. Anyway, Vincent said, yeah, sure. And blow me down, that came to pass. So I became first the European correspondent and then the bureau chief in London. And did can I just preface this by saying that I don't know a single journo who's worked at that, I'm going to say level, but I don't mean that in an egotistical way. I mean that sort of strata of stories that you're doing. I mean, you're literally flying. My first job, for example, as bureau chief, was to fly to Malta from London, which I think is still the largest hijacking death ever, land in the same plane as the one that was on the tarmac, completely shattered. The Maltese, so all I mean by that is it's human nature to look at that aeroplane and say, God, that's a mess, and then look around you and see all of the people who are in your plane and know that it's exactly the same plane.
Yeah.
So you land. The Maltese authorities didn't have the firepower to do anything about the hijackers, so they brought in an Egyptian crew, Egyptian squad of people with guns, basically. There's not much cover on a runway. You can't really surprise a plane. So when they stormed the plane, the hijackers rolled hand grenades, literally rolled hand grenades down the aisles, blew the crapper out of them. Sorry if I... Yeah, this was... Ugh. It wasn't day one, but this was my first big thing. So it had a profound effect on me. And again, we got taken straight to the morgue. Well, what is a morgue in a place like Malta? The answer is it's very hot and there isn't a morgue. So... bodies are laid out in an aircraft hangar under crude tarpaulins and things. So what is a body? Well, at that point, and again, I'm not trying to be crude, but at that point, a body is whatever they can find. It's two arms, two legs, a torso. That's one body. So we can sort out, and we'll sort out which pieces belong to whom, whoever. And on that very trip, I was introduced to an article that a CBS newsman, so this is the point of this story. I was, and remember, this is very early in my tenure, I was introduced to a story, the title of which was "Anyone Here Been Raped and Speaks English?" And it's a true story about a CBS, I think CBS producer, who went to a South American country where either the rebels, I can't remember, the rebels or the government had come through a particular village that executed all of the young men who might be a threat to them, raped many of the women. And so the field producer's first task, first thought was, you know, I've got 3 hours until New York goes to sleep and I've got to have a story up. I need someone who's been raped and speaks English. And then I realized for a number of years, in various ways, that's the way I thought. That's the most extreme. I'm not pretending that I dealt
sure,
with
sure.
that. But one way or another, that's the way I thought for... I'm glad we can swear on a podcast, because you wake up in the morning and you think, you look at everything, you read everything, and you say to yourself, what's fucked? So what are we going to cover? If it bleeds, it bleeds.
Leads,
if it bleeds, it leads.
So yeah. That's true, right?
Yeah. At that level.
God.
And it's like mercury in fish. You think you're getting it. You're the only one who's getting away with it. Yeah, I'm fine. But you're not. And so I want to tell you the end of the story first. The end of the story was that I came home, had a very nice, convenient, and much needed nervous breakdown. Now, I'm not a strong person in that way, and I'm not trying to demean or say that, that other people who did manage it are monsters. But I'll say again that, that every journo I know who's been at that level has come back with, and I'm not a clinician, but some version of PTSD. It's not that you can't unsee those things, but you can't unfeel them because you do nothing while you're there. You're this monster. You just record it. Yeah. You come into somebody's life for 20 minutes or whatever it is, and you pretend to know what's going on, and you put out a story and it's gone. It goes into the ether. When you're in London, you don't even see it. You don't even sit in the newsroom afterwards and say, well, good job, Ben. You don't even see it. It goes, and then it's the next
one. What's the next story?
Yeah. Really quickly, I went to a bombing in London. IRA, this is the IRA era. So glass is eviscerated, people, whatever. The IRA, being the beautiful people they are, wait 20 minutes till the salvos with their soup and their blankets and their kindness are there and the first responders are there and they set off another bomb. And then you arrive. I mean, what the fuck are you there for? Really, seriously. And you shoot pictures you know you can't use. You don't do anything. You don't contribute anything. All you do is you say, I'm going to get killed if I don't get this story up because Fred next to me will, because you know Fred from the other network. I'm obviously not Fred, but you know what I mean. And you think, what kind of mind thinks, I've got a good idea. Not only will we blow up random people, but then we'll wait and then we'll blow up the good guys as well. I mean, that does your head in. You can't sleep. You can't think straight. Does your head in.
There's a detachment that becomes a coping mechanism too.
Yeah.
It's like police, I suppose.
Yeah.
But there would come a time.
There are people who can do it. I know people who can do it.
What was your tipping point to suddenly going, I can't?
I don't remember the particular story, to be honest.
Culmination
I think it was mercury in fish. I woke up one morning and I was poisoned. Do you know what I mean? I think it was gradual. I honestly can't. I mean, if there was one, it's perverse because my only claim to fame as infamy fame, whatever, the only truly international story I ever broke, and I followed some, real titans of Australian journalism into this position, but the only story I ever broke was I found Bob Trimboli's body with his head on a brick in a little place in Villahermosa in Spain. And that's a long, dreary story of how we did. So there's this bloated, dead gangster. I don't know, for those of you who don't know, Robert Trimboli was almost certainly a murderer, but very definitely a very high-level drug smuggler who'd been on the run for many, many years. He'd been captured, he'd got away, he was sighted here, he was sighted there. The federal police were forever looking for him. Ended up, he was living in a tiny little, kind of a tennis community, a kind of sporting community under the name of, White, Mr. White, with his mistress, and ultimately died of cancer. Anyway, long story. So there's this naked dead gangster with his head on a brick in this tiny little cemetery, and we got there a full half day before the federal police did. I kept that photo not for glory, I swear, but to remind me that I never want to be that person again, because a part of me was saying, you're really cool. This is like a world scoop. A really part of my ego was saying, you are hot shit. And another part of me was saying, you are lost. You are completely and utterly lost if you think this is a good idea. There's nothing wrong with finding him. It was the way that...
But you had that voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
That opposing voice.
And I'm not criticizing anybody who doesn't.
I know.
There are people who uncover unimaginable things and do it with utter respect, and I wasn't doing that. I was doing that because I was I thought this was cool, and for me it isn't, and didn't deal with it and paid for it. But before that, I'd had the experience on the road to Damascus. Is it the epiphany on? Someone had encouraged me to do something else. So, okay.
You know, we do have something in common in that we both taught journalism in one aspect or another.
Yeah.
For me, it was mass communications, and it was journalism through the new media, digital media.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, someone coming from the old school journalism, how do you feel with the journalism today when people such as independent journalists can start their own news channels on YouTube, and Twitter has now become a important instrument for getting news out there. Is journalism taken a step forward or backwards?
Journalism's dead. The old journalism as we knew it is dead.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I'm not sure, because new media is still emerging. Newspapers are in decline all around the world. Only tabloids are succeeding. Radio is now rip and read, and radio is still the only one that talks to you one-on-one. Commercial television is an absolute joke. New media is our last chance, but it's still emerging. I'm not sure how it's going to shake out.
It's true. It's only been here since, 2005, 2010?
My hope is, because journalists, we like to think we're all kinds of things, but we're really just the most fleeting contemporary historians. That's what we do. It's just gossip with detail, really. That's what we do. So let's not get above ourselves. And I think new media is more than capable of doing that. Do I think it's doing it well at the moment? No, I don't. Mm-hmm. And I have fears for it, because I'm a free speech fundamentalist. I believe absolutely in the right of free speech. No qualifications, absolutely none. I believe there are enough legal remedies if I libel you or incite but as soon as you start tampering with free speech, who decides? Who decides who the good guys are? You know,
that's what's happened, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying do I enjoy some of the stuff that I see on Twitter, which is my main engagement with it. No, I hate it. But I'd sooner have those guys out in the open. Personally, I believe all human rights stem from free speech, and as soon as somebody mitigates that, it's a slide.
I agree.
Do I like it? You know, do I like flat earthers, Holocaust deniers, etc.? No, I don't.
But they have to
be there.
They have to be there, and there has to be a counter discussion to tell people how wrong or how right
people
are.
That's how we've always.
If you cut them down before the discussion even begins.
I think you give them a credibility if you.
Exactly.
I don't like to get into the whole cancel culture thing, but that's the sense in which I mean. I like them. I don't like them. I prefer them out in the open saying, you know, never landed on the moon or whatever they want to believe. That's fine. I believe some pretty strange stuff myself, and I'm fine with that. And I'm equally fine for people say, Bid, how can you believe that nonsense?
That's right.
You know, I'm fine with that.
Well, that's how we get to truth, right?
Yeah, you'd hope so.
By discussing.
You would hope so. not by me saying I'm never speaking to Wayne again because he doesn't like jam, you know?
Or, yeah. Like I heard a journalist the other day saying that she could never make friends with someone who's a Republican.
Yeah.
I was thinking to myself, really?
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 I lost two friends over a particular, I don't even want to go into the subject, over a particular subject that we disagree on. And I was thinking, really?
Yeah.
Well, you know me, you've known me for 40 years, you know. I happen to believe X, but, you know, it's not something that hurts anyone. It's just a belief I have.
I know. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. And no, gone.
I think people have lost the ability to simply listen.
Yeah.
People are not listening today. Yeah. They're already coming up with a counter argument about what they believe. Instead of just purely putting opinions out there, and then discussing it. You know, like I've got friends that I've grown up with from all different religious backgrounds. We're like the United Nations of religion. But it's fantastic because we've known each other since we were 13, 14.
Mm.
So we can just call each other whatever we want and their opinions. But, you know, we all sit there with respect and listen. And I think it needs to be done. I think that's why podcasting is pretty good in that way.
Yeah. It annoys me. I don't want to quote your great rival, Joe Rogan, but it annoys me that people make up their mind about people like Joe Rogan based on who he's interviewing.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. I mean, he's interviewing Michio Kaku and Neil deGrasse Tyson. They don't talk about that.
Yeah, that's right.
But he interviews one flat earther or whatever it is.
Well, what's great about
– he's a nut.
He's our lighthouse. Yeah. We're sort of – he taught me one thing. Don't read any comments. I mean, I get comments today every week about a podcast that was number 6 that I did.
Yeah.
About the tomb of Alexander the Great. I know the difference, but I accidentally said Greeks instead of Macedonian. And oh my God.
Sorry. This interview is over.
And I've apologized.
No, it doesn't.
And
so we can't be friends.
And you know, every week, I get that message. And no matter how many times I've sort of said, you know, yes, I understand
my
the difference.
Bad, yeah.
Yeah. But do I read them every day? No.
No.
Because if I did, I'd just be going back on, oh God, what did I say? What did I say? And I don't want to be able to have to think about centering conversation as I say it. I would never do that.
No, exactly.
If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. If I'm right, I'm right. And I'd admit both.
Well, I don't I have a lot of faults, but being able to unequivocally say I'm absolutely wrong, it's not one of them. It's not that hard.
No.
It doesn't give anybody any power or
And I'm wrong most of the time.
Well, before we get off journalism, I don't normally do this, but the post-breakdown, this is what I wrote, and I'd really like to read that.
Sure.
So it's called The Foreign Correspondent, and everything in this, to the best of my knowledge, is true. It's through the hyper lens of someone who is recovering from a breakdown. But anyway, okay, so I am the lone wolf, caged, but never truly captured. They drew bloodied rags before me, sent me, then send me anywhere. Abroad, the smallest wisp in my nostrils is all I need to do a dirty job. I swept into Luka Airport, slicing through a magnificent Malta moon, the carcass of a gutted DC-10 1,000 feet below. Hijackers had rolled hand grenades inside. They'd played 10-pin bowls with 200 lives. When the Egyptians stormed the plane, they cut down a few more in the crossfire. I worshipped at the sweaty makeshift morgue, dead meat on a hangar floor. Struggled to believe it was real, that they were real, that bought tickets, expecting to land to loving arms and homes, interviewed a survivor, wounded, wiser, calmer, profoundly more human than me at that moment. Filed, Kimbidstrip, 7, National News. This day they didn't have to call me. The pictures, live pictures, blanketed the BBC. I made the cruise travel arrangements, kissed goodbye to the people I thought were my family. Off Belgium, a packed passenger ferry had turned turtle, and the cruel channel had gone mad with flares and lights and choppers and fear, some of it floating, some submerged. I was so tired when we touched down in Brussels, gearing for the grim drive on. I fell asleep on the autobahn and nearly killed us all. Later, bulleting into Zeebrugge, I hit a German tourist, bounced him off the bonnet. Metaphor for a day, a job, a life. I told myself he was better off than me, at least what was broken you could see. And my first glimpse of a limping, lumbering death ship brought tears and disbelief at the sheer waste of it. Life is so very cheap in chilly waters. I filed, as always. They told me it was better than the other networks. Better death? Better pictures of death? Better words to describe better pictures of death? Better get drunk, mumbled Kimbidstrip for Newsworld. Trimboli's dead. said a voice down an early morning telephone line. It was conference time in safe, sanitized Sydney town. We think you ought to go. Go where? I said, listening to my own 3 a.m. echo. Spain, mate, Spain, just bloody go. Spain's a bloody big place, mate, I said as I put down the phone. Nevertheless, felt the familiar dread, booked the crew to Madrid, later cancelled for Alicante. Sure enough, there was Mr. Tough, Aussie Bob, bloated, rooted, way past sick with his head on a brick in a tiny cemetery in Villahermosa. I was first to find and film him, some naked gangster on the nose from several days dumped on a dusty dirt floor. Great work, said the network. I knew the truth. I'd violated a tomb, and not even an important one, whispered Kim Bidstrip for 11 a.m. When there was rioting in Brixton, I was there, pretending I wasn't. Was close enough to touch Fergie at her wedding, but didn't. Who cares? People like me create people like her every day of the week. It doesn't make them real. When the Bhagwan went to Crete, I knelt at his feet. It was purely professional, you understand, the profligate poet and the cynic, bankrupt gurus, both. Nietzsche was only half right, all the gods are dead. So I chanted Kim Bidstrip from the European desk. Now the lone wolf has become the lone gun, magnum man. You'd load me, aim me and fire me at the innocent ones. It's not so different, hack to hit man. You ask yourself, are you feeling lucky, punk? Did he fire six or did he only fire five? To tell you the truth, in all this excitement, I clean forgot myself. I blast them straight between the eyes. Kim Bidstrip, Gun for Hire.
If that doesn't sum up.
Yeah, that's...
Wow.
I have to say that's my experience post-breakdown. It was a cathartic, in a good way, piece to write. So before I left, let's talk about something happier. I'm happy to talk about some of the other stories we covered. But
well, something I really want to get to.
Sure.
Is your belief in the Hopi?
Yes, absolutely.
Explain to me the origins of Hopi.
Okay. So the Hopi are a very, very small, almost extinct, sounds like the wrong word, but tiny, struggling tribe that live on three mesas in Arizona, right in the middle of the Navajo Reservation. So if you know Winslow or Flagstaff, Arizona, if you were to draw points up, they would meet at about the Hopi Reservation. My father, among many, many, many other things, extraordinary, extraordinary man. Loved to talk about my dad. Loved Westerns, but he liked the real West too. He would regale me with fantastic stories of the real characters from the West, the Wyatt Earps and the Wild Bill Hickoks and the
Doc my grandfather,
the Doc Holidays.
Saying, yeah,
I mean, but the real stuff, you know, how Earp actually could have lived out his life. Only a couple of blocks away from where Elliot Ness lived, you know. I mean, and trying to put all that stuff and just this magical stuff about the Wild West. And I guess the best way of saying it is my dad fell in love with the cowboys and I fell in love with the Indians. And then I read a book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And I apologize. Just read it. It's a history, for want of a better word, of Native American suffering and betrayal, really. There's no other word for it. And I know there are stories, not stories, I know that's the truth here too. I can't tell you why this influenced me more than our own Indigenous people. I really don't know. But the more I read about Native Americans and the more I read in particular about the Hopi, I just found this tremendous peace with what they believe. There may or may not be a major Christian religion whose twin pillars might be described as fear and guilt. I'm not going to name that major religion, but if you were to name the twin pillars of the Hopi faith, they would be peace and balance, and I know which I prefer. So it's a very earth-based religion, although if you were to say to a true Hopi, you need to protect the environment, he would say, she would say, what are you talking about? What is the environment? And you'd say, well, the land. No difference. Well, you know. No, I have to be respectful. It will be respectful to me. They don't know the difference. When we say in a traditional Western culture we're all one, they really mean it. They mean the earth is our mother, the sun is our father, the moon is our grandmother, and everything, every, I doubt that Hopi believe in atoms, I really don't know, but if they were to believe in the nitty-gritty, they would say it's all one, it is indistinguishable, it's all a product and an expression of the great mystery. And that's what I believe.
Do you know what attracted to you within those beliefs? Was it what you just said with how we are part of everything?
Yeah, I think so.
Did they have a worship of the sun?
That's a misunderstanding. They revere the sun, absolutely. But the sun is our father. They do not worship the sun. The Hopi god, if there is one, is Te Awa, and it's the great mystery. It's the great unknown, the great everything.
So what is, from what I understand, because I was telling you before, I had a book years ago. I've got books here on all ancient cultures. Was it that the original people came from inside
yes.
the earth?
This is the, you've probably seen a very famous documentary called Koyaanis Kwartzi. That's a Hopi word. It means fourth world or the world out of balance.
Out of balance,
the
yeah.
The Hopi may believe that this is the fourth world. And that we re-emerged, in fact, from the Grand Canyon, re-emerged from the earth. The earth was flooded, this is their belief. This is the final world, incidentally, which is an interesting thing. And that various guides and things taught them lessons how to live on the earth. But yes, they survived the flood by being under. In fact, this little guy is...
Marcel?
Humpback flute player was the first of their guides to tell them
fuck the caretaker of earth.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. This is actually Kokopelli, but yes, Maso is the keeper of the earth. Yes, the Hopi were offered, for want of a better, an easier existence, or they were told that they could live a stricter life, but they would be guaranteed abundance. That the great mystery would never abandon them. They chose quite a harsh life on these mesas. And the traditionalists have stuck to that. Another thing that attracted me to them is that in Hopi society, there's only been one major rift or civil war, and it was settled by a tug of war.
Really?
Yeah. So you have old Orobai or Arabi, which is traditionalist, and you have the new one, which is still Hopi, but more modern or progressive or whatever. My business, in fact, is called Fourth Mesa, which is a bit of a conceit. So I like to think I'm the because they live on three mesas.
Do you know, I only clicked on that this morning.
No, it's no reason to it.
Yeah.
It's probably heresy. I don't know, you know, because clearly I'm not a born.
How do you know, though, Bid?
How do I know?
When they sent the people to all ends of the world.
Mm.
To find their center space. Mm. Am I correct?
Yes.
How do you know over thousands of generations you're not one of those people?
Interestingly, and this I will, yeah, look, this is, there is a fictional white person called the Great Pahana who will actually come. A lot of Hopi prophecies, which I won't go into, have come true.
First and Second World War?
Yeah, et cetera. Yeah, the United Nations, a whole bunch of other things, a lot of technology, et cetera, et cetera.
It's actually quite scary.
It is, yeah. Anyway, let's not go into Hopi prophecy just now if you don't mind. But but yeah, there is the Great Pahana. So I guess that's my big chance because he comes from the east, and relative to them, I am from the east. I am a white man, so I've got two out of the three maybe. But that's the only – it sounds like a – a line from a Bill and Ted movie. I know the Great Bahana, but yeah. Maybe I am.
No, but the one thing I remember, why I remember that book was when the Marsaw told them to go forth.
Yeah.
And I think I remembered people went clockwise and anti-clockwise.
That's correct.
But why I remember that was because in so many ancient cultures, you've got these spiral petroglyphs.
Yes.
That are represented we have it in the Burra.
Yes.
Up north. And Mesopotamia, Egypt.
Yeah.
Greek.
South America, yeah.
There's got to be something.
Yes. And this commonality of spiritual knowledge is, I just don't believe it can be accidental. I can't explain it. Seriously, you're a much more a student of that stuff than I am. But the commonality of mythology and religious belief and symbolism. I think Jung was a huge influence on me. The idea that I don't know whether it is collective, was it collective unconscious he called it? This idea that we have symbols that resonate.
I think so.
I think that's just so obviously true, that there are certain shapes, symbols. I believe in ritual and ceremony too. It seems as though there are certain rituals and ceremonies that are inherently enriching and understood, cross-cultural.
Sure.
I know there are some things that you don't do that might be offensive at a certain culture, but there are certain basic things that people recognize as deep respect, deep regret, deep love, deep connection, abundance, and they seem to be universal. And that, to me, this is why I love the notion of the great mystery, because it fits with... You can make it fit with quantum mechanics if you want, with quantum entanglement. You can make it fit with almost any spiritual belief. What better view of God than this? And I believe passionately in a creator. For me, what better view of God than this benevolent great mystery that we can't understand?
Yeah.
I mean, if you believe that God created everything, which I do, my chance of understanding that
is pretty
slim.
Well, I always say that. I always say, you know, what humans have been here for 260, whatever, 1,000 years. The Earth, 4.5 billion years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do we have an understanding? How could we? I mean, maybe in a couple of 100,000 years, maybe a better understanding. But
maybe.
Yeah. But the reason why we are drawn, because it's the great mystery.
Yes, exactly.
And we can find meaning here You know, the more stories that I came across from ancient Egypt to ancient Greece to the Old Testament, you start to see a lot of similarities from the older stories.
I would say the lessons from the great mythological journeys, the struggles, emotions tend to be the same.
The same. And they all refer to a great flood.
They do, yeah.
They all. So we probably know there was a great flood back in the day.
Yeah.
But I just find it so interesting of the similarities between the cultures. And that... is there a time where we are awaiting, like you said, we're in the fourth, what's it called?
Kuanaskwati, or fourth version of the world.
Of the world, yeah. And the Kuanaskwati is the life out of balance.
Yes.
Which I think we can feel, right? You know, they talk about corruption and greed, and it's our travels are going on a different path to what the Hopi wanted us to go.
Yes.
I think everyone can feel that today.
I do too. And then I wonder whether I'm being serious, whether I'm just an old white guy who's saying, oh, the kids of today, you know, is that just a version?
I think the kids are feeling it too.
Okay, yeah.
There's change.
Yeah.
There's a change happening.
It seems to me to be accelerating, not just tech, but the change seems to me to be accelerating. That's how I feel, but I wonder if that's a function of my... I'm reassured by what you say.
Yeah. No. I think, you know, when we talked about the spirals.
Yes.
Have you seen recently all the animals from around the world?
Yeah. Yes. Going
the
in.
The first thing I thought about was the goats.
Goats,
but,
yeah.
But there's been many.
Yeah, now. I know. I've seen the tubes.
So, you know, keep going back to, you know, is it the we're awaiting the blue star?
Yeah, right. Well, exactly, yeah. Very good. I'm impressed.
Well, you see, I pick up certain, you know, academically hopeless. Yeah. Read things I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I have like a photo. Photographic memory.
I do want to just revisit the prevailing perception that their sun worship is really doesn't do them a justice. They certainly revere the sun, and they understand that without the sun we can't do anything. So yes, they absolutely do, but they do not in any the sun is not a deity. The sun is literally our father because he brings us light and life and heat and warmth and a few other things. Just as the earth is our mother, because we come from her womb, she sustains us in every sense.
And water is important too.
And water is massively important.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you were to, I'll offend a lot of people here, but I think water, independent of Hopi beliefs, is the greatest issue in Australia by far. What we're doing with our water far exceeds any of the other problems we've got. But that's just a personal view.
In which way? This is interesting because my best friend is one of the managers at Water Corporation. He goes out and he used to do all the testing.
I just think that we live in a very dry, elongated thing where we're basically dotted along the coast. I'm generalizing, oversimplifying, but we're not very smart with the limited amount of water that we have, and we tend to be pretty profligate with it. Is my fear.
I remember a documentary where an old Hopi was talking about, if I can remember the situation with the water, and when the white men came, the Spanish and people like that, they say that if they had adopted the Hopi way of living, they could still drink out of any pond today.
Yeah, that's the Hopi. Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
And is it right that when you die, you know, you can become part of the cloud.
Yes, yeah.
Which then creates condensation to fall back to. So
yes,
we are, in essence, a merge of everything.
And science, you know, mainstream science will tell you that we're a hefty percentage of water. So it's
Sure.
I don't know what that percentage is, but I think it's well above 70, I think. So
it's, yeah.
Now, the progressive Hopis believe that is a religious allegory. Traditional Hopi believe that's literally true. So like all faiths, I think there are divergent views. But, yeah, that's absolutely right. I'll tell you one wonderful thing that I took from the Hopi too, and I used to use it all the time with
tobacco.
Not big on tobacco, actually. But they have this wonderful – that they carve cottonwood. They carve these little things called kachinas, which, again, are often referred to as deities and whatnot.
That's right.
They're not. Let's not go into that.
I heard that. I heard that the other day, the kachina.
Yeah.
Because some people said the kachina would accompany the blue star.
Yeah.
And reveal himself.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. That's a whole other thing. But anyway, they cut these. But one of the things they do, and this is a lesson for me, and I think for a lot of people, I hope for a lot of people, is if you have an issue or a problem or a challenge or even a good thing that you're looking forward to, you sit down with a piece of cottonwood and you focus entirely on that thing, whatever it is, good, bad, ugly, dot, 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 until it doesn't matter what shape you end up with. You focus your entire attention on it. So you get rid of Michelangelo-like, you get rid of everything that isn't, and you wind up with this thing, frequently with what they call a prayer stick. So it's a little image that you've carved, but it doesn't need to be. And then traditionally you would let the Sun Father, you would let time pass. You would let Grandmother Moon look at it for a little while. In other words, you would think about it. You would let the sun, you know, and then you let it go. You put it in its stream. I think that is the most sophisticated, elegant, beautiful way to deal with it. And I try to do that.
Letting go.
Yeah, letting go. The first part of the process is super important too, because it's not, but, you know, if I go on Wayne's podcast, this will happen. It's just that one central issue. You can't get distracted with all that other stuff. Oh, it'll be too hard to get there. Oh, you know, it'll be too hot. Oh, you know, I don't like Wayne. Whatever it is, you know, all that nonsense that really is not the central issue. So they force you to do it, really face up to it, let time pass, let the wisdom of the grandfathers and the grandmothers look after it, and then let it go.
Isn't that a great analogy of even who we are?
Yeah.
Because we go through that journey.
Yeah.
Throughout our lives, you're saying you're carving out, taking things away till you get to the purity of self.
Yes.
And then we pass through.
Absolutely. And what I've been amazed about is, and maybe this is not typical, but I've just turned 70, so that brings a kind of reflection, I think.
You do not look 70, mate.
I've had a lot of work done, lovely. no, thank you. Bless you. But it's the falling away. I thought it would be the learning new things. And I'm not in any way suggesting I'm, casting aside things and preparing for death. It's not like that at all. But it's the falling away of anxieties. It's the falling away of ego. It's the falling away of, sometimes it can be painful. There are certain things, this will give you a tremendous laugh, but since I was 10, look, everybody will laugh about this. You can have a good laugh about this, okay? I swear this is true. I always thought until I was that I could win an Oscar, okay?
I'm 10.
Yeah, seriously. I always thought, yep, I could win an Oscar. And there was a period in my where I actually believed, yep, going to win an Oscar. Believed it. Not dreamed it, believed it. Not complete nonsense, okay? I understand that. The falling away of that was so incredibly painful. Just letting go of the very idea was very, very painful.
Because there's ego attached to that.
But liberating. It is. So liberating. And there are so many of those things.
Totally understand.
That's just the most, the silliest of them. And it's like minimalizing your house or something.
Sure.
You know? It's this cleansing of just letting it go. You keep a, the truth is written on men's hearts, the Bible says, and you keep all those things anyway.
Yeah.
You lost your beautiful sister. You know, I still mourn my mother and father. But I've come to realize that they reside in me, right? You're wrong. They really do. In a profound way that I used to pay lip service to that. At 70, I finally understand that that's fair income. They really do.
Mm-hmm.
I talk to them. They talk to me.
Yeah.
The Hopi would say, and it is unfortunately a line in a pop song now, but, time runs through us like a fuse. So we're preparing for the next, my responsibility is to leave the joint better. We don't inherit the earth. We borrow it from our children, that notion. I know that's a bumper sticker now.
You're a star child.
Yeah.
Ed.
Yeah. Well, whatever. I don't know what I am.
Because isn't that what their purpose was in the Hopi? Is to fix the Kornoskat, is it?
Yeah, Kornoskat, yeah.
Yeah, to fix that imbalance.
Yeah.
To pass that knowledge on.
Yeah.
And I think that's, before I forget, speaking of the Hopi.
Yes.
When I was up north filming with the Indigenous Australians,
mm-hmm.
and we became good friends, and it was horrible because my experience of what you went through on a completely different level in journalism was I would be sent up with a mining company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we would do is we would work with the archaeologists and the geologists and the anthropologists. And the elders and the mining company executives that were there. And what they would do is a horrible thing, but what they would do is if they looked at a piece of land that they thought there could be minerals in there, but they would have all these relics from ancestors dating back 10, 20,000 years. So we would go there with the archaeos and they would document everything, and then they would have a ritual where they would relocate these things to another. It was horrible. And then 2 months later, that whole hill is gone, But anyway, I got to become pretty good friends with some of the elders. And they said that during a break, they said, Wayne, if you're interested in this, we had a very interesting meeting last year. The elders of the Hopi came to Australia.
You're joking.
To meet with the elders of the Indigenous culture here. And I was, can you imagine being at that? Because what had happened was it wasn't just the Hopi.
Yeah,
it was because I think there's how many tribes of Native Americans they are.
Yeah,
and I think there's 18,000 Hopi left. So what had happened was they wanted to learn off the Australians because they had navigated the way of the white man and their deals with the land better than what had happened over there, because they said what had happened there was with the casinos.
Yes.
And they said these young generation would sell the land, profit off the casino that would be put there. But now the younger generation now has become elders.
Yeah.
And suddenly realize what a mistake.
You can't sell your mother.
That
is,
was.
Is a Hopi proverb. You can't,
is it?
You don't sell your mother.
So they came here to meet and discuss what each of them had done. Mm. But I just thought, God, wouldn't that be fascinating? Oh,
I would. If I'm winning an Oscar, I would just love to be. I know of all of. And please, when I talk about to anyone listening, please, when I talk about these are my beliefs. I totally respect other people's beliefs, particularly Indigenous Australians. But I can only speak about.
You're drawn to something for a reason, Ben.
Yeah. Can I just say too that I follow this because I find truth and a degree of comfort in it. I find the Hopi talk about entering the silence. The Hopi talk about all kinds of things that resonate deeply with me. So I just want to say I don't want to offend anybody else's beliefs, but I think there's wisdom to be taken from all of these things, and it's universal. There's so much that's universal. And my cousin is quite a well-known musician. And he's worked for decades with Indigenous Australians. He was Jimmy Little's manager for a long while, et cetera, et cetera. So my cousin is Buzz Bitstrip, original drummer with the Angels, Ganga Jang, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Fantastic chap. And we have great discussions about
God, I haven't heard that in a while. Ganga Jang.
Yeah. So it's not that I'm unaware or have any disrespect for anybody else's cultures. I can only speak to what resonates with me.
Isn't it funny where we're drawn to?
Yeah.
Like I was telling you earlier, that ancient Greece and the stories that came from there.
Mm.
I don't know if it was an early childhood influence, but when I touched down there, I always thought it would be Egypt. But when I touched down in Greece, something happened. There was this energy that I felt totally at peace. I felt home.
Mm.
And I couldn't explain it.
No, it's honestly.
My mother, funny enough, she was brought up Catholic, and there's certain things in there that you believe and you don't believe. But the one thing that she had is her memory was her in a past life. She said she was in this water and she could just see her long hair and her sister that she knew was her sister calling, screaming from the shore, Leilani, and she knew she was drowning. But she said even though the water was really rough at that time, but she felt utterly at peace under the water. Now, anyway, she had this vision in these dreams for many, many years as a child. And when she touched down in Hawaii, she didn't know Leilani was a Hawaiian name. But when she touched down in Hawaii, she got that feeling of, and my mum hates traveling. Unlike me and my father, my mum hates traveling. But the one place she felt at home was Hawaii. And she said, I don't know what it is, but I know I'm not meant to believe in reincarnation. But what I felt, I couldn't explain.
Yes.
So it made her then look at other stories about that. Mm. So we have fantastic discussions now. Like I try and catch up with my parents, every week, and we have 4 or 5 hours of talking. And before they would quite shut me down at certain things I would talk about.
Spiritual things, perhaps.
Yeah, but even religion,
Yeah.
And talking about, how Christianity evolved and where it began and the stories. But now they listen.
Mm.
And it's funny, I think Fern had a lot to do with that. I think suddenly now they will sit down, they will participate in a discussion with views instead of an argument.
This gets back to what you were saying, or we were talking about earlier, that what comes out of that is enrichment. When you don't shut down the other, it's fine to have. Yeah. It's fine for me to have my beliefs, but you know, I have a lovely friend in Esperance who's a devout Catholic. You know, and we have great discussions.
Yeah, I love
that. I don't have to believe in transubstantiation, for example. Mm. Or what? And she doesn't have to believe in, you know, strange people that's who right. live on a mesa, you know, for us to like each other.
Do you know how similar that belief is to the Indigenous Australian belief?
Absolutely, yeah, I do.
Is that why you brought it up earlier?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the one thing I remembered, because I also have a book here on Dreamtime.
Mm.
And I had on a fantastic gentleman called Phil Narkle. Remember the footballer?
I do. I saw him play.
Incredibly spiritual.
Yeah.
He is from the Yellow Feather, and he was, after the podcast, he would sit down and talk to me about all the spiritual stories. Mm-hmm. You know, and it, you know, I said to him, it's funny, in certain religions and cultures, you know, especially the newer cultures, they have their big cathedrals, and you know, it is, the land is their cathedral. It is their church.
Exactly.
So you said it's very, that's why we are so connected to the land. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very upset when I was leaving up north. We were camping just on the border of Northern Territory in WA, in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And it was an incredible experience. I mean, the elder carved that Boab nut of my story. Oh, she said, that's my story. I'll show it to you.
Please.
But I was really upset coming back. And apparently these two spirits, female spirits, had attached themselves onto me and the sound guy. And we were quite worried about that. And they got their neighboring tribes to do a smoking ceremony too. But this lady came up. She put her arm around me. She said, Wayne. You know, I said, yes, auntie. She said, when you go back to Perth, whenever you feel down, that's still our land too. Go outside. The trees there will help you.
Look up.
The skies, the animal totems.
Yes.
They will come to you in need when you are in need. Just because you're in the city, it doesn't make a difference. You can still connect yourself. I never forget that.
Right.
And it's funny, whenever I am going through a little bit of a, you know, time where I'm rushing things, I've had to slow down a lot over the last few years. Wayne, slow down. I never forget her words. And, you know, one of the reasons why we got this place, one is so we could travel and lock and leave. But the land where all our windows face is these amazing trees. And we're right in the city. But next door to us is all these trees and birds and wildlife. So whenever I feel that, I'll go. And I'll be around. I'll take walks around parks, and because of what she said,
absolutely,
never forget that.
I'm blessed to be able to do that much more easily than you,
especially with your photos.
And just look up. I mean, the Hopi say look up, for a variety of reasons. I'm really sorry. I need to go to the toilet. Is that?
Yeah. Now look, okay. We can close. We've been an hour and a half already.
Yeah, sure.
But Bid,
we haven't talked about acting.
I know. Look. Whenever you're back. Come on.
All right. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Can talk about different things, and I'm trying to get more people back.
I would love whenever to. Have we really talked for
an hour and a half? Yeah. Whenever you come to Perth, if you've got an hour free, let me know ahead of time. Come on the podcast. We'll talk about this and
I would love to talk about acting, but I guess that's the thing you talk most about. Sadly, for the reasons I was telling you about before, I probably will be back. I would love to. Absolutely love to. Have we really talked for an hour?
It goes so quick. Oh, it's an hour and 25. Okay. But it goes very quickly. People that come on here are very nervous. There's a woman that hands wouldn't stop shaking. And then an hour goes past. She was like, have we spoken for an hour? I said, yeah. I said, that's the amazing thing. That's
how podcast. How long do you, because I noticed, I think maybe the one with the painter, I think was like an hour and a half, I think.
Yeah, they're all, look, the first few podcasts, They were like 2 hours, and a bit hours. And then I started to realize, you know, like Wayne also, because I'm doing the editing, so cut it down.
I know about that, yeah.
And, you know, bring it down to an hour, hour and a half. Normally an hour, but I'm noticing in the last few podcasts it's been about an hour and a half. And it seems to be a good time because what people are doing, they're listening on the way to work.
Yes.
And then they're listening on the way home from work, which is great that they actually come back to the podcast.
Mm.
And more people now have started, like I met this Mexican girl the other day who, and this guy from Italy said that they watch the podcast. And I was like, you do? Because normally it's like, you watch? Because no one watches. And slowly I think people are starting, because I love the fact that where people can, who is this?
That's me too. I love that.
Who is this man called Bid? You know, this mysterious Hopi man that was a journalist and this happened to him and now he's an actor, a voice actor since 1974. They want to see you, but please come back again. Whenever you're around, and if all goes well and you're around, as in coming back to Perth, let me know ahead of time. And then we'll have a chat about something else if you've got an hour and a half free. Thanks, brother.
I will. Thank you.